Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 2 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
I'm Blake Howard. This is the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans. A Michael Mann film-inspired podcast tackling everything about the 1992 film The Last of the Mohicans through a very specific lens. Its finale. And oh boy, is it an all-timer of a finale. Soaring score from Randy Edelman and Trevor Jones's adaptation of The Gale. Unbelievable performances by Daniel Day-Lewis, Madeline Stowe, Russell Means, Eric Schwieg, Jody May, Steve Waddington. Lensed so stunningly and staggeringly by the legendary Dante Spinotti. And directed by Michael Mann. We have a war party of cinema's sharpest minds along for the ride, all culminating with the mountainous director himself, Mr. Mann. Welcome to the show.
Today, my guest is, well, he threw an absolute bomb on me after One Heat Minute, after all of our time talking Heat, after going off and making a really muscular William Friedkin-esque badass crime movie, after all of our languid discussions about contemporary crime, this guy drops a bomb on Twitter and a bomb right onto me and says, you know what? My favorite Michael Mann movie might be Last of the Mohicans. And it just so happens that in the madness of the occurrence of this project, this man's truth bomb, this reveal, this unexpected twist has made me want to talk to my dear friend who I've talked to many times about Michael Mann by now. And it would feel, if I did this project without him, would just feel incomplete. Ladies and gentlemen, my awesome and talented filmmaking friend, Joe Lynch. Joe. Welcome.
Thank you. So, wow, that was a hell of an intro. And I could say that we would both be considered manspurts at this point.
Manspurts, mansplainers.
Yeah.
Some people.
Manspurt actually does not sound very good upon it, like, falling from my lips.
Manspurted out of your mouth. Then...
Oh, no. This has already gone off the rails. Thank you so much, Blake. And first off, let me just say that as someone who was a fan first of One Heat Minute and has become, I guess, part of the One Heat Minute team, in a way, or guest team, to see how that crazy experiment, art installation, which I like to call it, culminated with you sitting down, well, virtually, with Michael Mann. Dude, that was one of the best episodes of any podcast that I had ever heard.
It really was,
dude. And it's not lip service, and I swear I'm not just doing this because we still have a lot to talk about. But that was, I mean, you could not have gotten a better ending. The only ending better would be the last 12 minutes of Last of the Mohicans.
Well, that is right. So for folks, if this is your first episode because you're now Fangoria Presents Movie Crypt podcasting fan and a diehard, you're going to be listening to this going, the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans, why is Blake going back? If I did listen to any episodes of One Heat Minute, it's the one with Michael Mann, and he said, I told you I was never going back. Well, Michael Mann is going to be the final episode on this show.
And what?
And doesn't it feel even more gross that after speaking for 130 hours on one movie to not try and talk about what makes this movie a complete masterwork in its own right, in a completely different way, and particularly why my focus is, and I know that you've even just talked about it, your most recent tweet, like talking about the third act of this movie, the finale of this movie, the last 12 minutes of The Last of the Mohicans, really going from the Huron Sachem sort of judgment being laid out, Duncan's mm-hmm. sacrifice, Magua exiting with Alice, Uncas's tireless pursuit, that entire vignette, silent action film in the middle
pure
of this.
Cinema. It's pure cinema. If you can count the amount of dialogue that happens from the moment Duncan sacrifices himself until, you know, Magua's ultimate demise, there is maybe three lines of dialogue.
It's pure cinema.
Pure cinema, an eclectic sound design, performances that you've been completely invested in, some of the most evocative visuals that have ever been captured on film in a time that I think you could still be able to get the American, you know, vista in a pure and un-CG form. And this was one of the first movies. Do you mind if we go back? Can we go back for a minute, Blake?
Let's go back.
Okay. Because, you know, Last of the Mohicans was one of the first films that in my, like, nascent days of discovering not just movies, but auteurs and cinema and the voices of these artists. You know, I remember the time, 91, when I had seen Reservoir Dogs and went, oh my God, this guy is speaking on a level of movies and pop culture and, you know, and just cinema language in a way that I had never seen before, or at least seen in a recent film.
Yes.
And that felt like it opened up my world. So, like, that open creative wound in 91 was, like, literally just, like, completely wide open, ready for anything. And I specifically remember my mom, who was a big movie fan herself, she would take me and the boys after school sometimes to go to do either one movie or two movies if we were feeling up to it. And she had been such a big Michael Mann fan, along with my dad, of Miami Vice. And, you know, I enjoyed Miami Vice, but Michael Mann was not the same Michael Mann that I revered ever since. It was, oh, that's the guy who really enjoyed Phil Collins and Fast Cars. And he was, to me, he was a modernist.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, he was one of those directors that you could go give him a gun, a flashy car, and the neon skyline of LA, and you know he's going, or Miami or New York or whatever, and he's going to present you something that feels fresh and of the moment.
Yeah,
you know,
ahead of the moment, right? Like, so when think of it, he was a tastemaker. And so when you think of him, and people think of him often in that contemporary context, even when you throw back, it's like, he's like, no, I'm going to create the style. I'm going to create the templates for what the future is. I'm going to see where the gaps are.
They always talk about world builders, right?
Yes.
And they always talk about, like, Ridley Scott and Stanley Kubrick. And I feel like, and especially once this movie came out and has, you know, stood the test of time, you know, Michael Mann is also one of those amazing world builders that you don't realize it's a world build until you've seen the film, you know?
Yeah.
Thief, even The Keep, and obviously, you know, The Insider and, you know, and all the other public, even, you know, Public Enemies in a way, but there's very few filmmakers that go to the level of detail and authenticity that is not only there just to get the actors in the moment, but the audience is so ensnared by all the detail that he puts into it. Like, looking at the behind the scenes documentary that's on the Blu-ray, you know, there's these shots of just these soldiers and they're just hanging out and they're sipping coffee and they're around a campfire and stuff. And the way that he shoots it almost feels like documentary style.
Yes.
Until you realize that, my God, by the time you get to the third act, you're not looking at the level of authenticity. You're just so in that world that all you care about is the characters, and you're so invested in those characters. So to back up, you know, my mom would take us to the movies, and this was, you know, the multiplex days where, you know, there'd be 12 movies playing all the time. So she decided, like, all right, we're going to go see Under Siege, the Steven Seagal, Gary Busey, Tommy Lee Jones, Andrew Davis classic Under Siege.
Chewing.
And if we were up to it.
The scenery being chewed to death.
Oh, my God.
In the best way possible. And never again has there been a scenery chewing pairing like Busey and TLJ in that movie. Oh, my goodness. That is fun. Yeah, go.
And by the way, like, Erica Eleniak, like, pops out of a cake naked.
Of course.
Let's just say that it was the best afternoon screening ever, or so we thought, right? Now, look, it's my mom's got three young boys. You know, Under Siege is, like, the perfect movie for them.
Perfect.
So she was like, yep, we'll go see that, but I want to go see this movie after The Last of the Mohicans. And I had a cursory interest in it because I had just seen My Left Foot on video. And I thought, man, I'll see whatever that fucking dude does. And, you know, I knew about Michael Mann a little bit. Weirdly enough, in Entertainment Weekly, they would have, like, these fall previews, right? Yes. Where they would kind of detail all the films that are coming out that season. And I'm pretty fucking sure, and I kind of remember this, but they would have, like, director Michael Mann, and then writer. They would have the writer underneath. And I think they made a typo because it said writer Michael Mann and Cameron Crowe.
Yeah, not Christopher Crowe.
Yeah. I thought it was Cameron Crowe. So I actually went into the movie thinking, well, if it's the guy who wrote Say Anything, like, I'm curious to see what the hell this is all about. So unfortunately for Christopher Crowe, like, I didn't go in for him. But I was like, of course, hey, I'm going to go see a second movie. And I remember I have not been that affected by a film since seeing Chuck Russell's The Blob in the same multiplex. I was completely blown away, so much so that that night we were driving back and there was a CD store. Remember these places called CD stores?
We remember them well.
We stopped off and I got the soundtrack that night. Because it just blew me away on so many fronts, not just visually, but orally as well. Like, the sound design, the music, it opened my eyes. And I, from that point on, I remember becoming obsessed with Michael Mann. Because again, this was a movie that was out of his comfort level, at least on paper.
Yes.
You know, when Madeleine Stowe, when she was reading the script in the behind the scenes, she said, this reads like an action film. So, but, you know, like, they keep saying that it's a love story. And she goes, but I underestimated the power of Michael Mann. But even then, if you looked at any of his earlier work, Manhunter, Thief, The Keep, you know, Miami Vice, of course, you would think that it was going to be a muscular action film. Yet, watching it again yesterday, which any chance that I get to watch that movie is a joy and a privilege. So thank you for giving me the excuse to sit down in the afternoon. Like, when I tweeted that out, I had people going, what kind of fucking job do you have where you can sit there and watch a 2-hour movie during the day? I'm like, it's research and it's very important. But you know, looking at that film again, it's such a joy to watch, but it's also, it always comes down to, well, it's the Michael Mann historical film. At least at that time, it was like, well, you know, he's trying to do a period film. It felt like it was out of his comfort zone. But watching it again, it is so much a Michael Mann film that it has all the same visual flourishes, even down to, like, in the beginning of the – like, no, in the middle of the film when Hawkeye is about to shoot Magua at one point, it's the same exact shot construct from the moment when Al Pacino shoots Tom Sizemore in Heat. The same exact fucking shots. And I can't fault him for it. That's just his language. You know, that's like telling someone, you know, that's like telling to say, like, no, don't say okay or all right. You know, like, you can't do that. It's just part of his visual language and how he was able to use a lot of the same kind of visual tricks and the same kind of visual language in a world that feels so completely removed from his normal kind of modernist cinema tropes is so refreshing to watch, even today. Like, watching it again, there's so many period films. Like, I just watched The Patriot was just on, Mel Gibson movie, right? With Roland Emmerich, who directed that. And what's really interesting is that you think about period films and how they're supposed to feel as nebulous and timeless as possible, other than maybe the actors who end up being in it. In most cases, you would hope that a film that's set in a period can kind of supersede when it was produced, right?
Yes.
But you look at The Patriot, and that movie feels incredibly late 90s.
Oh.
It does not feel like it could stand the test of time, whereas when you look at Last of the Mohicans, the way that man approached it felt so fresh and so modern-like that it does not feel dated one bit. I mean, even looking at the performers, you know, I'm watching it now going, I bet I could fool someone into thinking that this movie was made today and they just visually de-aged
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Or that he somehow in his rigorous body sculpting somehow figured out a way to de-age himself through acting. I wouldn't put it past him, but the Last of the Mohicans on every level has, from the themes to the visualization to the sound design and down to the performances themselves, feels as fresh and of the moment, if not, like you were saying, you know, ahead of its time even today. And this movie's nearly 30 years old.
It's really funny, Joe, that you said that there's a very particular flavor of Michael Mann's contemporary flair when it comes to just his like film grammar. Like, he just kind of gets it. There's just something that continues to translate in everything that he does. But the only other movie that I think where you can really see, and Mann does it better than anyone because he's got the sort of modern sensibility, but he doesn't ever lose the sweeping scope. Like, and I guess that's the landscape too. But I remember people discussing Christopher Nolan's The Prestige, and they were talking about like, this is a period film about magicians in 18th century London, early 19th century London, and it shot like any contemporary film. But that's the style, like a very deliberate style to kind of shoot this like a bit of a modern thriller, and use all of the tricks and tropes that doesn't do any of the scaling to scope and say, hey, this is the setting, this is what makes it feel sweeping, this has got that classical look. It kind of denies all of that. And what's great about Michael Mann is that, like, he will, especially because of the sort of claustrophobic nature of tackling those forests and things like that, it does feel there's all those contemporary war elements. There's that militaristic understanding that he has of that authenticity of how to wield weapons. That's all his stuff. But the undeniable thing is that he pairs that with just gorgeous framing and beauty in a way that's just, it's what other, I don't think other people who've tried to do that have realized that, no, you need the romance, you need the deep romance to earn it. Like, to earn those bits that you want to do, you need the romance, you need the sweeping, you know, vistas, you need like the scale of watching an entire fort exiting somewhere in a valley to only be ambushed on both sides by crazy bands of warring Huron.
With real actors, real landscape.
Yes.
You know, as much as, you know, now being fully ensconced in the kind of, you know, movie making machine, whenever you're making a movie now, there's always, like, if you read in the script, you know, beautiful vistas and, you know, gorgeous landscapes highlighting, you know, the expanse of a location. In most cases, there is likely now going to be a visual effects component, whether it's to erase planes or to take out a building in the horizon or a drone shot or even just like power lines.
Yes.
There is a need now, because the world has gotten so small, to digitally enhance those moments. Whereas, and this is something that I didn't notice until watching it again today or yesterday, is there is an amazing amount of very long, very wide pan shots along horizons that I feel has been lost in the cinema language of today.
Yes.
And maybe it's just because the necessity of using CG, you know, to enhance a location, but there, you know, there's something very elegant about, and there's four or five moments in this film, including the final cliffside confrontation, where man, you know, who was inspired by Thomas Cole landscape paintings.
Yes.
By taking the idea of having very small humans in a very long, like big, wide landscape, and really using that 2-3-5-1 frame to basically create living portraits or living landscapes, and that's just something that I don't see anymore. You know, even just as something as simple as going from point A to point B and landing on someone or something, but at the same time creating stakes or creating a landscape itself. Like, you know, not to jump forward too much, but, you know, one of the most amazing shots in that final 12 minutes is this beautiful, almost helicopter-like pan along this cliff and this huge vista, and then it ends on Magua's team, you know, walking up with Madeline Stowe and Alice and everybody, and, you know, following their trail. And just by doing that, man, and he does it a bunch of times before, but just by doing that in that moment, you know where the location is, how expansive it is, what the stakes are in terms of, like, oh shit, someone's gonna fall off that motherfucker, and how small we truly are. You know, there's something that's very important that Mann says, and I think it applies to the entire film, but particularly the ending moments, is that, you know, the frontier is a conflict between past and future, and that's the theme of the movie. And how he's able to create that theme visually in a world that is not entirely in his comfort level. You know, like, the people talk all the time about, especially like in the 90s into today, where, you know, there was a trend of bringing foreign directors to do Hollywood movies. And one of the conceits that I remember reading and I thought was, well, that's an interesting take, is that to bring directors who don't live in Americana and in that culture and allow them to present us with a version that might seem a little more objective. And there's something somewhat romantic about that in a way too, how they can, you know, romanticize certain things that maybe an American director wouldn't highlight. Well, here's an American director in the modern times who's almost been time warped back into the 1800s. And they said, you have everything at your disposal, go. Just capture these moments. And just by doing these shots where it feels at times that he's almost saying, like, the world is getting smaller. Let me present you with the widest viewpoint I could possibly give you. Because if, you know, you think about it with a 2-3-5-1 frame, and if anyone listening to this ever gets a chance to watch this on the big screen, you'll feel like you're watching an IMAX film. Because what he's doing is he's presenting to you 50% of this vista at the beginning of the shot, and then sweeps across. It's almost like, you know, the panoramic option that you have on your phone.
Yes.
That's what he's doing in a way. He's sitting there going, like, ah, shit, I'm not following the arrow. Fuck, too high, too low, shit.
But just by doing that. The most stressful phone mode, just as an aside.
Oh my God. How many times I've been on a set or just out and I can see, like, someone just looking at me like, panorama mode, huh? And I'm like, yeah, shut up. Just let me get this. God damn it. The arrow is going too high or I'm going too fast. But just by doing that, Blake, you know, you can tell that man is, he's world building with your eyes.
Yes.
And so much of the film predicates itself on building that world around these characters so that, and really, if you think about it too, you know, by world building around these characters and creating what ultimately is a love story first using the backdrop of the French Indian War, that's what ultimately creates the most evocative storyline for us. Because, look, I don't know if anyone's ever seen Revolution or 1776, but colonial movies can be fucking boring sometimes. Or even, you know, films of that era. I remember when Bruce Beresford's Black Robe came out, I think the year before. And I won't lie to you, man. I remember seeing that on video because someone was saying, like, oh, man, it's fucking really violent, and anything that I can go get at the video store that was really violent, I'm like, sign me up. And I remember watching that movie and being completely, like, and I was admiring the attention to detail. That's all great. But there was no story.
Yeah.
And in a way, it felt like what Mann did was he harnessed the need and the want for that kind of attention to detail so that the audience is completely enveloped in. It's not just something that looks good in a press release or the marketing materials. Like, we went for pure authenticity. But just by having all of that feel as real as possible, the audience isn't looking for the seams. They're not looking for that one extra in the background who's got a Spuds McKenzie t-shirt on, or you know, like, there's no one in the background, or even like a detail like someone's car or even a plane going overhead. You forget it. But midway through that movie, by the time you get to that one battle in the middle of the film, which should technically be the battle at the end of the film by all Hollywood
by all rules that you should actually be adhering to.
Everything is broken with this film, and just by doing that, he makes you invest in those characters so that by the time you get to the moment when Daniel Day-Lewis and Madeline Stowe are making out in what is arguably the best fucking makeout scene in cinema history, and it does another pan across the darkened horizon and ends on them.
Yes.
You don't care about anything in that world other than those two people and the people around them that are going to affect that dynamic, you know?
And it's so funny you brought up this, to throw back to that wonderful exchange I got to have with the great man himself. He talked about, you know, in North Carolina in 1992 or 1991 rather, when they're shooting this movie, he had to ask for the flight pass to be changed. That was the last thing as far as authenticity, to get those vistas, to get those things, because mm-hmm. the landscape was uninterrupted. But when they were, even when they were scouting, you know, they're in helicopters and things like that to scout this extremely dense North Carolina landscape. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, no, I did get the planes changed in Mohicans. And he said the sort of funny throwaway line, he's like, I got the planes flight pass changed at Mohicans. He goes, but now I wouldn't care. I'd pay $1,000 and those contrails or whatever exactly. would be gone. But there is something to be said when you know that it's all, like, it's just one of those undeniable things. It's all happening in the frame. I had a weird and wonderful experience very recently to go and see two movies back to back, which I think are just two completely different examples of what movie making can be. One of them, I saw Francis Ford Coppola's The Final Cut 4K at
you got to see it?
Got
oh,
to see it
man.
On the big screen. It was beautiful. I saw it with two One Heat Minute alums, Stu Coot and Garth Franklin, and we went and saw it. And literally several nights later, we were all together seeing Hobbs and Shaw. And we were like, and this is with all respect to those filmmakers, it was like, how does Hobbs and Shaw even call itself a movie when Apocalypse Now exists? Because the Francis Ford Coppola's madness writ large on that screen with the multiple helicopters that are literally all in the frame. And we were like mm-hmm. sitting next to each other, like going, this is all actually happening. It's
actually happening. It's something that, you know, when you grow up in loving the movies like we did in our age before the digital era, when part of the spectacle of going to the movies was that little voice in the back of your head that said many people and many things had to happen for this shot.
Yes.
Like,
and
for
many
example,
people are doing something in this shot to yeah. make it feel how it feels. There are 100 people. There are yes. 11 helicopters. They're all... Yep. bouncing and can, you know, and that's one thing I love about Mohicans. Every time I watch it, especially in those scenes at the fort, there are guys digging in trenches. There are yeah. people pulling massive cannons up onto mounts and firing. Even though it's rubber, they are rubber cannonballs. But even though
there were basketballs, weren't they?
Yeah, basketballs, basketballs, painted black. But they are firing projectiles and smashing real North Carolinian wood because they just chopped the forest down in the clearing and they built the fort out of the wood that was there.
They built the cabins. They built everything. Everything. It's all there. And that level of artistry is something that I think producers and executives who are trying to save a buck, all kind of push by the wayside. Like, don't worry, we can do that in post or fix that in post. But I mean, look at the success of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Knowing going in that Tarantino went slavish with all those little details, in the back of your head, you're enjoying it more that it wasn't just some dude in Crete who's creating these visual effects and it's not tangible. Yes. And there's an appreciation for that. And that's why, like, a movie like this, if this was made today, half of the film would likely be CG, you know? And I hate that's true, but it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, a moment when you have the infamous ambush that comes, you know, right into the third act, there's, the, you know, first off, you have that one that one Huron, you know, tribesman runs out in silence and whacks the one dude.
Oh my god,
hell is breaking loose, and it doesn't. But then there's that one crane shot where you just start to see, and all the guns are going off, and all the all the warriors are coming towards them, and the shot holds and holds and holds. You see Korra on the horse starting to go away. That kind of shot would likely have been mostly composited now. But to note that that probably took all day just to get that one shot, you can't deny that kind of craftsmanship.
No.
It completely immerses you.
And for people who are listening to this miniseries, Dante Spinotti, you have to listen to the Dante episode, but Dante even talks about, and you talk about, there are many people responsible. He's like, in that huge sequence, because they had all those people there and they were getting all those shots, he goes, there might have been five crews. Like, there was the main unit, there's obviously second unit, third unit, and there's just other folks running around, grips and people shooting things just to make that all happen and then orchestrate and edit all of that into this cohesive form. He's like, it was madness, but because we were creating all of this with all these people, we just didn't want to waste any of the amazing shots that we could get with all of the sort of chaos that we were orchestrating. So yeah, no, there's something undeniable too, Joe. This is the thing, is like, this is 92. Once you do Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, it's like, it's kind of the watershed moment, because, and it's much like Jaws, you know, a lot of people sort of go, oh, Jaws is when they created the blockbuster. It's like, if you watch the first half of Jaws, that is a really deeply cynical new Hollywood movie about a mayor, a mayor who'd rather have his populace eaten than lose any tourist dollars. And then it becomes a really swashbuckling action movie, right?
Once again on the Orca. Once they're on the boat, it's a summer blockbuster.
It's a summer blockbuster. But there's a whole part of that that's not there. The Fellowship of the Ring, in that other example, is so much is tangible, so much is physical, so much is pure New Zealand, so much is that. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is there is a fusion with digital to a certain extent, but the movie is of a smaller scale and at that beginning. Once you hit Two Towers and you get into that, you know, which is what 2003, or sorry, yeah. 2002 rather, once you hit Two Towers and you've got the Battle of Helm's Deep and 90% of it is digital, and you've just got these 10% corridors of real people that are doing the inserts and the close-ups and the close neck-to-neck battle scenes, it's like that's the moment where it pivots. It's like you've got all this tangible and all this physical and all these real people that in the old movie-making days would just be this big Ben-Hur scale epic style, and then you've got the digital fusion, and so many people were like, oh yeah, well, we can just take that even further. And you're like, no.
Exactly. They take it and they regress with going, well, you know, like we understand that you couldn't have orcs. We just need regular dudes. So we can just take that same application, the same technology, and apply it to something that should be more real.
Yes.
And yet there's an artificiality to it that no matter how exciting it is, it's still going to ring a little bit false to the audience. Like, yes, as much as I love the MCU movies and I really enjoyed Endgame, you know, that final battle, you're sitting there going, 90% of this is in the computer and it loses a little bit of the oomph. Now show some kid that, and then show them either the final battle in this, or even like Braveheart, and go, other than maybe some of the digital, you know, erasing of planes in the background, that's real dudes in there beating the fuck out of each other.
Yes.
And you can't not go, ooh, ee-ah, where I didn't once go, ooh, ee-ah, when I was watching the big fight at the end of the Avengers. I was going, oh man, that must have taken days to render. I shouldn't be thinking that. I shouldn't be. And audiences, look.
I wish that was on the poster. I wish that was on the poster. That should have taken days to render, Joe Lynch.
I don't think it would help Avengers Endgame at all if that poster pull was on there. I want to talk about something that I didn't know, and this kind of pertains to the final minutes of the movie. You know, when I tweeted that yesterday, that I was watching the movie, which I'm wont to do, I like doing that because it creates a dialogue and a conversation with other people. And I would much rather that than talk fucking politics. So if anyone wants to talk about Last of the Mohicans or chime in about it, that's what I love about expressing what I'm watching on Twitter or whatever. And, you know, immediately when I mentioned the third act, so many people talked about the score, the music, the score. And, you know, like, again, like I said before, I was so blown away by Trevor Jones's and Randy Edelman's score for that film that we immediately had to like pick up the CD, and it became my homework soundtrack for at least a good year.
Yes.
So now, like, any
shit, homework was exciting. Homework was way more exciting for a whole year.
No, now I hear it. I start to see algebra and social studies, you know, things like blasting in my head while I'm hearing the mandolin. But one thing that I never noticed until watching it again, and, you know, back then we didn't have IMDb, but it was something that was on the Blu-ray that made me go, holy shit. As much as, again, we keep talking about how Mann might have seemed on paper out of his element, and that he was still kind of making his movies the way he makes them. You know, one of the things that everyone knows Michael Mann for, especially in the 80s, was his deft use of needle drops and practical tracks from artists instead of score, you know, and Phil Collins in the Heat of the Night or whatever. That's a prime example of there's someone who knows how to use pop music and juxtapose it with or seamlessly integrate it with a scene, and it feels fresh and it feels vital.
Feels like it was made for it.
Exactly. I don't know who's calling, but that's probably a telemarketer. I didn't know that the song, that the music score that they use, you know, the main score when, you know, the big siege on the cliff happens, I didn't know that it was a needle drop. Did you know that?
Yeah, I found it out in my research. It's Gael is...
The Gael. An old Irish Celtic song from way back. And the story behind it is fascinating how...
That his wife recommended.
It was his wife. They couldn't find the right track. And Michael Mann's wife was just happened to be listening to Irish folk songs or whatever and went, you should listen to this. And I thought maybe it was just inspiration. And then I immediately went on YouTube, listened to the song. I'm like, that's the fucking song.
That's the song. The key melody is there. And what's amazing is he goes and dumps it to Trevor Jones and Randy Edelman. And he's just like, hey, this is the whole movie. Now arrange the goddamn living shit out of it. Like, I need this track to be for the peak of love, the peak of sorrow, despondency. I need it to be soaring. I need it to simmer. I need every single thing you can give me at every single tempo. And you just watch them, and it is actually one of the most beautiful sort of I don't know whether you'd call it like this, like weird, strange, like x-ray or excavation or dissection. It's like they literally do things to this track in ways that maintain its like DNA, but completely fuse it and change it and tweak it to do whatever is required of what's happening on screen. It's crazy.
What I noticed this time was that, especially when you watch the whole film again and you start to hear Trevor and Randy's various themes, you know, Nathaniel has a theme. I mean, Hawkeye has a theme, and the women have a theme, and the British have a theme, and the French have a theme, and Magua has a theme. And all of these themes are basically scoring these variant subplots that are all going to come together on that cliff.
Yes.
And when you listen to, again, right in that moment that I talked about before, when you have the camera sweeping over the landscape and landing on Magua's crew, every cue for the entire film converges.
Yes.
It's like a perfect song where you have different melodies, and then when they converge on the last bit right after the second chorus, you go, this all fits. It fits perfectly. And I mean, thematically, you can't do better than that, where you can have everyone's themes all fit as if they were separated, and now this is the full true.
Yeah, it's like a weird multi-track. Song. It's like a weird multi-track thing in your brain. It's like, here, we're going to turn this track, this part of the track on, it goes, and it'll just have that tempo, and then it's like, let's put that next track, and then next track, and then as soon as that blast, that horn blast, the beautiful wind instrument part of the orchestra all go da-na, and do that big pan. And Dante Spinotti is not intimidated by the panorama on his phone, I'm guessing.
No.
Not at all. Dante is fucking fearless, right? That pan, when it whips across and that blast of the horns, and then we see Uncas again, it's just like, oh, here we go. This is everything.
I'm getting chills. I'm getting fucking chills just thinking about it. But that's what you need, though. Like, for a story that is trying to envelop you in all these different characters, I mean, Uncas is as secondary as you would think, and even his father, played by Russell Means, I mean, they seem like they would be secondary characters in this film and even in the first two acts, because really you're worried about Hawkeye and Korra, you know, like that's the heart of the movie. What you don't realize is that by that, you know, that ending mark when Uncas is running up the cliff and he's going to find his real true love with Alice, that's the moment where the shift in the movie focuses more on the Mohican family and the Mohican tribe and how that's really, they are the heroes of this. And like, if anything, Hawkeye becomes secondary to that.
And isn't it one of the most beautiful storytelling bait and switches?
Like, I had no clue. No one did.
I can't even imagine. Like, you know, when people talk about it, we all go back and we all go, "Oh, Chingachgook." You know, Russell Means, he's the biggest and greatest badass. And in examining this with the level of scrutiny that I have want to do in these projects, I've watched that ending scene like on a loop, like over and over and over and over, and I'm just trying to remember. Like, firstly, you get Steve Waddington playing Major Duncan Hayward, number one. What a fucking thankless role on paper. But yep. God, when you read that last note, that last beat, as a person who's like going for that movie, he would have gone, I fucking can't wait to do this movie. And he crushes the movie. Like that switch to like be self-sacrificial and to join Hawkeye and Korra is so powerful. That's really gets me in that
the
moment.
The look gives.
Oh.
Especially when Hawkeye says, Did you tell him? And he goes, yes, I did. And
okay. This is the inside baseball bit of you and me. I love that. He's like, did you tell him? I've always thought there's a passing look, and I know you're going to go back and look at it because I know you, but there's a passing look. I feel like Sachem knows how to speak English, but he speaks French better.
Oh.
So when I see that moment, there's a look that the Sachem says, and he looks at Duncan and he looks at Hawkeye, and then he's like, oh, I know what's just happened here. And every time I watch it, I feel like he knows how to speak English. Cause if he knows how to speak French, I'm sure that he knows how to speak English. And I just looked at him and I'm like, yep, he knows. And so that's even more of his mercy in that moment to go, I know what he's doing.
Yeah. I gotta say, between this movie and Hunt for Red October, it's a very difficult trick in trying to create a dialogue between languages and having a translator in the middle of it, right? Yes. You know, Hunt for Red October did it really well, but if you listen to the soundscape and you listen, especially if you have headphones, if you get a chance to watch this again, which I know all of you will, that translator scene is so technically complex. You have two running dialogues going on and you have Duncan underneath it translating for both. And realizing at the same time that he's translating for both, but he's also translating his own death sentence.
Yes.
It's heartbreaking, and yet he completely keeps himself poised and composed, and he's still professional and regal. And it's heartbreaking to see how, who is normally a foil in the construct of the love story. You know, he's the other guy. He's the Bill Pullman of the story, if you will. And yet the honor that he elicits at that you know, in the end when he sacrifices himself. And it's interesting too, watching it back, I think other movies might have lamented him or at least, you know, held on his process more. But it's at that moment, and that's really when the score kicks in, when he makes that decision. And he, you know, his body, yeah, his, you know, you cut, he,
his
you
decision cut is the trigger. His decision is the trigger to the ending. That, which is why I sort of, it doesn't, so that's why that this show considers this ending, this the last 12 minutes, is it encompasses part of that decision and it encompasses the shift because it's so critically important in that moment, the hero moment, the confrontation for Hawkeye and Magua. And for Duncan in chorus with Hawkeye in that moment for Korra's life is, it is the foundational moment of that because so many things happen in like 40 seconds. He's self-sacrificial. Yeah. We're also hearing.
And then he's immediately put, he's put to the flames immediately. Yeah. Like there's no dragging out the stop. I mean,
you're not going to Albany to get hung. You are just literally mounted on a pike and you're up there.
And you are up there. And you know, it makes me think about the construct of what a hero's journey is in these last 12 minutes, because think about it. Does Daniel Day-Lewis get a hero moment in those 12 minutes?
Nope.
Duncan does. Uncas does. I'm going to screw up Russell's name. Is it?
Chingachgook.
Yeah, you say much better than I do. Chinga, we'll call him whatever. He gets a hero moment. Even in a way, I hate to say it, West Studio gets a human moment. Yeah. But everyone who was considered the peripheral characters on the press release for this movie become the heroes in the film. I think that, you know, if there was a hero moment for Hawkeye, it would be that he shoots Duncan in that moment. You know, like that's just the, out that's of mercy.
The, yeah, it's mercy. That's a hero moment for him. But think about it.
If
you're making the movie about the great American hero and really 10 minutes before the movie ends, he gets the hero moment and his dad.
And then he's out. He's just in the background going, stop, no, Uncas, that's it. Everybody else who's been supporting Hawkeye's quest and supporting Korra's love are all the reason why they are together at the end.
Yes.
You know, it's so important that I would almost say that this film is more of an ensemble than people think because of that final 12 minutes. And you don't realize it until it happens. It's like if you were watching Ocean's 11 and then you think it's a Brad Pitt and George Clooney movie, and then they save all of those great character moments for all the other nine guys for the last 12 minutes. You know, they all get their comeuppance moments.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. And the one thing that I would say is this movie has been reframed totally for me just watching, you know, maybe it's because of how many times I've watched him and I just thoroughly adore him in Heat. But like, is this not the whole movie, the tragedy of Magua? Like we talked early in our conversation about Michael Mann's intent and about that beautiful contrast between this is where the past, you know, the past transitioning into the future. This is where it's happening on the frontier. Like that's the journey. And so Magua's this tragic guy whose entire family gets murdered as part of this English progress of colonializing this continent. And he's going on a revenge journey. In any other movie, he's a hero. Like he's like a vengeful hero, if you like, going to take out the guy who killed his family or ruined his family or whatever, or caused him to be enslaved. And he's so intent to like do things that are going to help the Huron progress and try and adopt these other things to stay alive and to survive and not be extinct. Because I think he sees the writing on the wall better than anyone else. And when he's in this judgment and the judgment's passed down, it's devastating because he's like, he now has been in an attempt to save his tribe for the progress and the devastating sort of reality of the situation. He's then cast out and he does this wonderful thing, which I want to underscore for people in a few episodes of this show so you can go back and look at it. He doesn't curse out the chief in Huron. He curses him out in French.
Which, yeah, I know. That was what a great choice that was.
I mean, what a choice. Because it's like, I'm not even going to talk to you in your own language or in our own language. I'm going to talk to you and I'm going to fucking curse you out in French because our time is done.
For Le Francais. I love how everyone refers to it as, watch out for the Le Francais. and you bring up a really good point, too, because, Magua, they always say, your movie is only as good as your villain, yes. Right? And the best villains are the ones that can justify their intentions. And that's what I feel like. Wes Studi became a star by the end of that movie, and it's all because of his hand.
Mm-hmm.
That emotes way more humanity than you would ever expect, and I'll get to that. But, he's truly one of the best antagonists because it doesn't take much for the audience to flip their point of view a little bit and understand his plight and his people's plight. And if this was any other movie, he would be the Charles Bronson in this Death Wish.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, it's unfortunate that in a Western world that you wouldn't be able to make that switch as a kind of star vehicle. I mean, considering that he made, oh God, what was it? The movie he did like two after this, that I think Walter Hill directed. That was
Geronimo.
That's right. I mean, even still, they had to put a bunch of white guys in there to kind of fill out the cast list. But I think that Magua's character is the most empathetic and complex of everybody in the entire film.
Deeply.
Because Mann gets to play with the deeply rooted politics and the class struggle that you might not expect going in, because everyone's going in to see Daniel Day-Lewis's abs and the love story. he gets to have a relatable antagonist that by the end of the movie, you can't not, at least, especially when he's, presenting himself to the chief, or even there's that beautiful moment where the camera pushes in after he's just been attacked by Russell Means, you can't not feel empathy for him. And what better way to really throw the audience into the fray than to have them go, I kind of side with Mago on this one. I don't know. it doesn't happen often, but
not
by having someone who can create a character that can be all utterly terrifying. When he has that black makeup on during the ambush, you can't get a scarier foe.
And also because they do this wonderful, there's something so deeply wonderful about that shot, which is when it sneaks into the bush and they're just pulsating along, like he's the head of like a snake and the scales are like what feels like 10,000 guys that are just like following him so deathly silently in those woods. It's so scary. And then when he stops and pauses and you're like, Oh shit.
Yep.
This is going to go.
But then when we get to one of the most heartbreaking moments in cinema, when after Uncas is thrown off, which I got to say, God damn it. Who's the actor? Is it Eric Schwieg, right?
Eric Schwieg, yeah.
Who is, again, you don't expect him to be much in the movie. And then he's got that step slow-mo process moment in the waterfall with Alice. And you fall in love with him immediately and you know the stakes. But his, like, revenge mode, like action moment, when he is truly like on full tilt boogie to save his love. And he's given, a really very honorable, moderated fight. One thing that I noticed in this that, I don't think you get away with a lot anymore is, fight scenes in movies have to be so fast and fast and furious, so to speak. Everything's moving very quickly. And the thing that I really enjoy about watching, especially the last two or three fights in this, is that the fight between Uncas and Magua, it's a very moderated fight. There's a lot of pauses in it because there is a respect between two human beings, two warriors.
Yes.
And that is a respect that unfortunately has gone away thanks to the industrial age, to the advent of muskets and rifles and now, fully automatic weapons. The fact that you can have two people who have different opinions who can converge, whether it's with fists or knives, and there is a mutual spirit animal-like respect between these two human beings that they can step back and reflect on, oh shit, you just stabbed me three times.
yes.
and even giving what would be considered an honorable death too. You know, the way that that Magua, you know, kills Uncas. Yes, he's an adversary. Yes, he's standing in Magua's way. But I feel watching that, it could have been way more brutal or even more like sinister. It wasn't.
He takes, like, so this is the wonderful contrast of this movie. And I think that why everyone gets that human and hero moment that you just underscored is you watch Magua cut a guy's heart out, and he is taking that. That is him at his most brutal, and that is him at his most savage, you know, and he's executing that savagery to make a point. It's not like he wants to do it. He's claiming the most sort of overt point that he can. But in that Uncas scene, he's like a robot. Such a good killer. Like, he's so good at killing.
He's the Terminator.
Yeah, that's Magua at Terminator. And he just does it. And what's so powerful about Wes Studi's performance, and just why he's a criminally underrated actor. I mean, he literally acts the shit out of Daniel Day-Lewis, and Daniel Day-Lewis is arguably the greatest actor working.
and he steals the movie.
The whole movie, just takes it away from him. If he hadn't already stolen the whole movie from him up until this point, the last 10 minutes he completely steals it from him. But there's that moment where he's cutting him, and he looks down. And again, this is both the glory and the pain of having beautiful high definition transfers now and watching something so crisp. You see the blood spatter on his face during the execution.
Oh, I know. It was brutal.
And he's disgusted. He's like, why am I, like, there's no satisfaction. There's no bloodlust. He's just doing it as an autopilot. And he just goes, oh, what? And he pushes him away. He's like, I'm done. Like, I don't need to do this. And then that body sliding down the mountain, like,
and so lifeless. Even the moment where, and it's a very shaky shot that seems like they might have just kind of captured it in the moment, when you have the body that almost looks like it's floating down.
Yes.
You know, it looks like something that was just kind of spur of the moment. There's an lifelessness to whatever dummy they used, that if they had used a stuntman in that moment where it's like, oh,
yeah,
I feel like it would have just been lost. There's something that's heartbreaking about that. So when you have Jodie May, who plays Alice, who, again, if you think about the time spent between Uncas and Alice is probably 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Yet that moment under the waterfall speaks volumes.
Yes.
And when, you know, when she notices what's happening and realizes that her love is gone, I can hear an executive go, well, you know, that really wasn't that well defined. So, you know, maybe we can, like, add a couple scenes in the second act that can strengthen that. Doesn't matter. There is such a heartbreaking sadness in her face. So much so that there's fucking gifts for it. Like, when I did that, there were just gifts of her face in that look.
Jodie May. What a cliff. And what a powerhouse, and, like, literally has to earn her whole part in the movie in 4 seconds of glorious close-up.
Like, she's not given anything else other than, like, oh, we're understanding that in the throes of battle she has to grow up very quick. You know what? That's Madeline Stowe's arc too. So she's already got that handled. But to have that kind of loss, and it's the kind of loss that you were all hoping and praying doesn't happen to Hawkeye and Korra. So it's almost an example of, this could happen to our A story, and this would be the most devastating thing ever. By taking all our B romance and shredding it apart, it not only creates, you know, pure empathy for the audience with these characters, but gives man the ability to create humanity in Magua.
Yes.
Because that moment where it's like the switch between Terminator and Terminator 2. Where you are so focused but you're so focused on this machine, and a machine that has a real salient reason to be doing what he's doing, even if it considers, you know, brutal violence. The fact that look that Wes Studi gives her, realizing that she's going to commit suicide, and how his eyes lower and his head tilts and his hand comes up and just gives a little whoop whoop. Just like a quick little come back. And the fact that there's her lover's blood on that.
I thank you so much for talking about that, because I think in the GIF culture that we live in, there's a GIF, and I don't know if it's just cropped effectively. It's like half of his hand is always seemingly covered in the GIFs. And when you see it in beautiful,
you don't
true
get the
form,
blood.
And I'm like,
you don't get it in the true two. There needs to be more 2351 GIFs out there, I guess.
In the 2351 GIF department on Twitter, you can see the blood on his hands. And that's the perfect literal and metaphorical Michael Mann thing, totem, in that moment of like, she's stuck between death or the hard fact of the negotiation that the guy who she would be with, who would protect her, also has the blood of her lover on his hands and also has this Terminator kind of quality in him. And also, you know, he may have satiated some of that craziness and some of that desire and be forging out onto this new pathway. And maybe there's an opportunity that there could be some other bit, but ultimately she's a woman who, like, arguably 2 months ago is tottering around in London at court, you know, waving a little fan and being courted by dudes in there. And she's just been thrust into the French Indian War. Like, I don't blame Alice for looking helpless, because guess what? I'd be fucking Alice in this whole movie.
She was literally between a rock and a hard place.
Yes.
And it's, and you know, like, suicide is a tricky thing to portray in cinema.
Insane.
And create something that can be justifiable to the audience and even romantic. And that's where I think, you know, Mann excels in, by having, this is so weird. Okay. If he had framed it where Cora falling in that lower angle didn't have Wes Studi's hand in the shot, I think some of the impact, no pun, of her falling and the acceptance of it would be diminished, because there's, and I would love to have been a fly on the wall, you know, setting up the shot and knowing that, okay, Wes, your hand is going to be in the shot. What is your hand going to do when you realize that she's accepted her fate? And there's something about when the second that she starts to fall, his hand falls a little bit. It doesn't fall all the way, but it falls just a little bit. And, you know, contrast that with the moment when Luke Skywalker falls, you know, in Bespin, or like, you know, down that hole in Bespin, and Darth Vader extends his hand, and it's almost the same kind of beat. There is a sadness to that gesticulation.
Yes.
That is so, that's the moment to me that Wes Studi became a movie star.
Yeah.
Because he could emote with his fucking hand.
Yes.
And create something that is not going to deter you from, you know, an overly sentimental or schmaltzy moment like, oh, well, that girl died, let's keep on moving, or I feel bad, but what are you going to do? There's such a complexity to that emotional beat that is so hard to create otherwise in any other construct, that makes that moment sing. And it never feels false. You can't talk to anybody and say, well, yeah, she made a mistake. You know, like, no, that's the most romantic gesture you could possibly give to your lover. And I also remember, weirdly enough, I thought, having seen this movie 20 or 30 times at this point, I thought I remembered seeing a closer shot of both of their bodies down in the ravine.
Same.
But I don't know why. It's almost psychosomatic, where the movie is making you think that you see
them together.
Something that was, because you know what? Every other filmmaker probably would have done that.
Yes.
Where it would have been a closer medium shot of both of their bodies twisted and broken, but their hands are barely touching or whatever. You know what? The fact that Mann almost gives you the point of view as if you were someone up there with them looking over.
And you just see her white dress. That's all you see.
That's all you need.
All
in
you
the
need
palette that they've created, the only thing that you need to see as like almost a visual anchor is where her body is, knowing that they are together. That's all that matters. You don't need a schmaltzy moment of anything closer. It's just that. But what makes that scene more powerful is that the person that was the antagonist to this, you feel bad for him too. You feel bad that he couldn't save her.
Yeah.
Because he could have. And yet love conquers all, and unfortunately love also means death. So yeah, man. Like, and then after that, there is just, and it's interesting too to see how Mann keeps most of that scene in real time, yet gives Russell Means the moment of slow-mo when Uncas
The most Peckinpah moment in this movie.
Oh,
Russell Means, who is so laconic, and I love. There's two things that Mann does here in slow mo reaction shots to death, and for the Uncas shot, he gives Chingachgook, who barely says a word through the entire film, that slow mo scream, and we're denied hearing it. He intentionally denies the audience the, I don't know, satisfaction or whatever. Or keeps him the dignity so we don't hear his, like, guttural, like, freak-out cry. And then when Cora sees Alice, we only hear, like, a whisper. It's almost like there's, like, a dog whistle kind of... saying that... It's so different because it's, like, we only capture the most heart-wrenching frequency of her devastation just for that split second. Like, ah! Like, it doesn't even feel like it's real. And then... we get that punctuate, like, so that sort of like paced into the scene. And so then when Chingachgook's like tearing up after to happen, so we know he's in tireless pursuit, and we know that Hawkeye's like streaming up the hill. It's that wonderful like levels of anticipation. You're like, well, we know that this action, this emotion, we're really heightened, we're invested. But as soon as those two things, and when she, you know, Madeline Stowe's character gets to do that for Alice, you know, Corey gets to react to Alice, then we're on that charge. And then the music changes tones again. It's like, almost to your point, the orchestra shifts. It goes like, it's like it takes away a couple of those key higher end tracks, those tragic notes, and it just all becomes this big, like,
when it becomes a John Woo movie for 30 seconds, when you have fucking Daniel Day-Lewis with two fucking rifles shooting two dudes. The only thing that was missing were some like colonial era paper flying in the background and a couple doves.
So
but,
cool.
You know, like, you know, you bring up a really good point about the slow-mo. What's interesting is that you have our three main characters. You have Russell Means' character, you have Cora, and you have Hawkeye. And the two characters that are directly related to the dead, you know,
yes.
You know, Russell's son and Cora's sister, they are given the same almost wordless slow-mo, you know, reactions. Whereas Daniel Day-Lewis's character with Hawkeye, he gets real time and he's the only one who says anything in practically the entire sequence.
Yeah. He screams out brother. Really he screams out brother in Mohican.
I thought it was like, doesn't he go like Uncas or something like that?
No, he doesn't say Uncas. This is the thing. This is the real nerdy part is I was trying to figure out what the hell he said for the longest time. Cause he says Nakans. And if you go back to the very beginning of the movie, when Russell Means is saying that sort of beautiful prayer over the stag that they kill, he says, you know, thank you so much. You know, and I think the final word that he says in that exchange and under the subtitles, it says brother, and it's Nakans. So he's run So when Hawkeye runs around the corner, he goes, Nakans, like brother. Ah,
dude. Again, I've seen this movie 30 fucking times, and I'm still discovering new things just like that. I swear, I always thought it was Uncas. But what's funny, too, is, and I want to get to the sound design before we wrap up, the way that is in the soundtrack, it sounds distant. It almost sounds peripheral. It sounds like a throwaway moment.
Yes.
Because, you know, as much as obviously Hawkeye and Uncas have had a relationship together, they're not blood. And that shift... that moment, in a way, is Mann saying, Hawkeye's taken a step back. He's now become secondary. He's now the objective observer. And now letting the native people, you know, whether it's, you know, of the English descent or of the Mohican descent, we're bringing them first and foremost to the forefront because it's really, it's their battle more than anything else.
Yes.
And I think that it was such an important choice that I don't think would happen in other movies with other directors because they'd be like, well, who's the dude on the poster? You could see an executive going, huh? That's the guy we should be focusing on.
You could do 100 sketches about Michael Mann movies getting studio notes and him just rejecting them. You just need someone really laconic and just like, no, I'm not doing that. It's just like, so the guy on the poster, he should, you know, be in the big battle at the end. No.
We don't need him at all. I will mention really quick that the thing that you talked about previously about saying the prayer in front of the elk or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that's another classic man trope is the idea, the theme of the honorable death.
Yes.
And that's something that obviously carries on with pretty much every major death that happens in this film, you know, all the way back from the animal that they kill to the final moments between, you know, Russell Means and Wes Studi. That pivotal shot with the vista in the background, and it's a wide profile two shot between these two men, these two tribes,
these two mountains,
exactly converging together. That again, in a more modern action, or maybe, you know, an action film set in today's world, that moment would never happen.
No.
Or it would happen and the audience would go bullshit. You know, it would feel hammy and staged, where nothing, like I was saying before with, you know, with Uncas's fight, nothing feels staged because, and or theatrical, because here are two characters who have respect for one another. You know, it's not the ruthlessness that we're so used to in storytelling of the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. This is storytelling from a much more respectful, humanistic place. And that's what makes it both visually stunning to watch, because you're like, oh my God, these are the true heroes or villains of the story. And this is what we've been building to. It's in the fucking title, people. It's not Hawkeye's tale. It's The Last of the Mohicans. I remember when this movie came out and everyone thought, you know, like, that's who they were referring to, was Daniel Day-Lewis's character. It's like, no, they even say it at the very end of the movie.
He says it himself. It's so hilarious. It's the great Matt Zoll-Zeitz, a wonderful writer and editor of RogerEbert.com. Matt's so wonderful. But Matt's like, Blake, I've got a theory that whoever says the title of the movie is who the movie's about. Now, whether you prescribe to that at all in Michael Mann movies, I actually think it works, because you know Robert De Niro says the heat coming around the corner. So, you know, it is essentially a Neil McCauley, you know, focus in some strange way. But in this movie, you know, Chingachgook, like, the once you've seen it, you realize, oh, it is him. It's him trying to, like, it's them trying to pass through so that they can set up roots and, you know, and bloom as a people, as a family. Mm-hmm. And so this digression, which it is, right? They ultimately take a, you know, cheeky little digression along the frontier through the French Indian War. you know, and that's what they do. But once they do that, and there's an exchange that we didn't get a chance to chat about, but I think it's so important to that final scene, is when Uncas grabs his dad's shoulder, And he's not looking in his eyes, but he's just touching his shoulder. And Chingachgook looks up, and he looks up into his eyes, and he follows his eyes then over to where he's looking, which is to where Alice and Magua's guys are exiting camp. And yeah, then he sort of, like, there's a something that passes there that, as a parent, he has to go, I'm letting go.
Yeah.
And he it's
so affecting. And it's tantamount to Mann's thesis of, as much as it's great to hear this beautiful period era dialogue and, you know, to feel that authenticity come out of people's mouths, it's way more important to create a dynamic of looks between these people, because that's how we realize that's how, you know, the family of brothers and father speak to one another when they hunt. That's the that's really the moment when Korra falls in love with Hawkeye and says, I want you, with her eyes. That's the moment.
Don't we all wish that people could look at you the way Madeline Stowe looks at Hawkeye? Like, if you've ever been looked at like that,
damn it,
hot damn.
Yeah, I can say that my wife gave me that look once, and we're forever together. It's true. It's very true. That is a very specific look that she gives, and it's fucking steamy as hell. I love it. But, you know, like when Duncan and Hawkeye have that look, every significant dramatic moment in the film, I mean, obviously between Chingachgook, I can't say it right.
Chingachgook.
Chingachgook. You're much better at it than I. But between those two moments, or those two characters, and they have a look. You know, these looks are as important as any big set piece, explosion, squib that goes off. It's the like, you can tell Mann saw those moments as being the big trailer moments, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, like, those are the moments that you have to harness and pray that the audience connects to.
the final thing I want to say is I've just heard in this project, and I hadn't heard before it, this is where you really like, you know, so for people getting frustrated with the Oscars, this is where I really like them. This year, an honorary Oscar winner is none other than Mr. Wes Studi.
This year?
This year.
No way!
Way.
I had no fucking clue.
I had no clue either. I've only just heard about it. I was having a tangential conversation with one of our Australian Universal Studio execs, Mike Bard, a friend of One Heat Minute, who was on the show, and we're having a chat. And he made me aware of it, and I just... So now what's going to be wonderful is talking about Last of the Mohicans Forever and talking about the fact that Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis starred alongside Academy Award winner Wes Studi.
Like, and you know what? When they hand it to him, they should say, this should be for Last of the Mohicans. Sorry. Yeah. Like, we held off. This one in the back. It was yours all the time.
Sorry. I don't know who the hell got this, but this had your name on it.
I just had a crazy fucking thought. Okay. We've been talking about Last of the Mohicans. We've been talking about Heat, obviously. I never made the connection that Michael Mann cast two of the scariest antagonists of 90s movies as good cops.
Yeah.
Between Ted Levine being Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs, who is iconically terrifying, and Wes Studi as Magua being incredibly terrifying, and having them in these roles that, you know, like, for all intents and purposes are secondary roles to our main conflict in Heat. See, it always comes back to Heat, Blake. It always does. I remember watching Heat, and the first time Wes Studi shows up, you're like, oh shit, he's probably going to turn bad. Like, there was something intrinsically, like, embedded in my brain to think that,
and you're like,
probably a bad guy.
And you're
probably
like,
a bad guy.
And you're like, as soon as you see Bosco, you're like, I'm sure he's wearing women's underwear. Like, I'm just 100% sure.
Yeah, right? Like, you know, there's something amiss, and he probably, you know, sings Wild Horses, you know, in the car on the stakeout or something. But, you know, Wes Studi, you know, and there's not a lot of meat to chew on in Heat, but he's fantastic in that movie, and he's completely sympathetic and knows how to fucking open a shotgun, like a door with a shotgun, like nobody's business.
Like nobody's business.
Fucking badass. But, you know, Wes Studi has become this very Studi has become sturdy,
yes,
as a fantastic character actor that, you know, is going to bring a grounded gravitas to whatever, if whether he's playing the good guy, the bad guy, or someone in between.
He's just got confidence, Joe, right? He's still. He can be still and you're completely intrigued. Like, he doesn't have to be doing fucking anything. And he's just there. Last movie I saw him in was Hostiles, Christian Bale.
He's that movie.
So good. And, you know, we talked about Geronimo before. He's been in, a slew of movies. But, you know, whenever I think about him, it's like, you know how good a character is when they transcend the actor, like, in a way, and that's how good the performance is. It's like, for many years when I saw Wes Studi, I'm like, fuck, it's Magua. Like, it's just like, that's
how,
like,
can you not? I mean,
it's,
you know,
like,
it
that's
worked,
who it is.
It worked against him in the movie Stephen Sommers' Deep Rising. Did you ever see that movie with Treat Williams?
Yes.
Dude, okay, all right. If you didn't, you need to, like, stop this podcast now and watch it, because I guarantee you'll be doing, you know, one deep minute very quickly. It's such a great movie that people are starting to
realize. That's my Deep Impact podcast, Joe.
It's happening. No, you know, you should do a Deep Rising and Deep Impact podcast together. That would be perfect. Just call it Deep. But Wes Studi is, he plays the heavy in that movie. But what's great is that he's hilarious in it, because he knows that you know him from as Magua.
Yes.
And there's little subversive touches that he adds to it. And I spoiler alert, he dies horribly in the movie. But the way he dies and how he dies, it almost feels like you can see him looking at the audience going, you wanted this in all those other movies, right? Well, I'm giving you the best Wes Studi death you could possibly imagine. But he's just one of those actors who it's enjoyable to watch him take whatever role he is.
Yes.
He's in. And you know, I think it was really smart of anybody who cast him after Last of the Mohicans to not just lean on, like, oh, well, you know, he's of Indian descent. We might as well put him in every Indian film that we, or Native American film that we have in our pipeline.
Yes.
Geronimo obviously is one. But, you know, I remember him in Street Fighter, you know, seeing him in Heat and in a role that you wouldn't expect him to. You know, Deep Rising as well. Fucking Mystery Men. You remember him in Mystery Men as the Sphinx? he's so reliable, but I don't think he'll ever come to...
God, that's one I haven't watched in a while. Mystery Men is fun, man.
Mystery Men is a lot better, and
he's fun in it. He's so fun in it.
But he knows that you know him as the heavy in most of these movies and plays off of that, you know? I remember him in this... Walter Hill movie Undisputed that was with Ving Rhames and Wesley Snipes. He's fucking great in that. He's just one of those actors that, you know, has been reliable to all of us as audience members, but it all started on that cliff. I truly believe that I don't think he would have, I don't think he'd be getting that Oscar this year, Blake, if he didn't have that moment when he calls Alice back. Oh, I truly believe that.
I think in a modern time, it's so funny when you go back and go, that's the, you know, the fun of punditry with the Oscars as film geeks is you go back a few years later because you think about what really is zeitgeisty and then you see what endures. And I'm just like, there's no performance in 1992 as a supporting actor that's better than Magua. It's just not.
Nope.
Like, there's a lot of good performances around that time, but I'm like, there's none as good as Magua. I'll put Wes Studi against almost anyone.
Put Wes Studi against anybody this year.
Yes, I agree. Let's go back. Let's just submit it. I'm sorry. You guys got it wrong. You're going to need to assess Wes Studi's supporting performance against everyone else.
What we need to do, Blake, is we need to totally Kanye West the next year's Oscars and be like, hold up. I respect you. You're great. But we should just bring out Wes Studi now. I know he's waiting. He's got another hour before his honorary Oscar comes out. Let's just give it to him now. Let's make amends for 30 years of fuck ups. Let's just make this right now. Come on out, Wes.
And you just see Joe Lynch as a Oscar host scratching the name of whoever's name was on the Oscar.
I'll soy bomb the shit out of that stage just to make sure that Wes Studi gets the Oscar he so well deserved.
Oh, so well deserved. So well deserved. Oh, my goodness. So we've talked about sound in this movie. We've talked about Randy Edelman and Trevor Jones absolutely cutting up and cutting to pieces the Gale. But I know that we talked about sound designs. I'm going to just lead you in because who would have thought that, like, musket flashes could almost take over cymbals? Who would have thought that, like, like that guns dropping can be part of the percussion? Who could have thought of, like, the pitter-patter of feet charging up rocks could also just be immersed into all of the orchestral notes that are hitting in this final, you know, this final scenario? It's just, the marriage between sound and the music here is chef's kiss.
But It's also very experimental, and I think if you've seen enough Michael Mann movies up to that point, you know that he has a lot of credence towards the sound design. Like, you hear it from so many filmmakers and artisans in this business how, you know, sound is almost half of your movie.
Yes.
And, you know, if you've seen all the movies that Michael Mann has done since, especially Heat, even The Insider, he enjoys playing with sound design and sound mixing to a level where it almost becomes expressive. And I never noticed up until that point and rewatching it again, how silence is so much a part of this movie. There's moments in the film where we will kind of travel out of a scene, like letting the war party leave a scene and we're panning down to the water, and how the sound cuts out completely, like,
yes,
no sound. There's a difference between having atmosphere, very light atmosphere, where there's like a kind of controlled quote-unquote silence, and there is absolutely nothing on the soundtrack, and for all intents and purposes that's considered a no-no.
Yes.
Because in some cases, some sound mixers will disagree with me and say, well, that takes you out of the movie. Now your ear is fishing for audio in that world, and they don't get it, and it makes you go, oh, I'm watching a movie again. But there's many moments in this film that it doesn't feel like he's trying to manipulate you to think you're watching a movie. He's trying to allow you to heighten your senses the way that Hawkeye does and the way that his family does when they're hunting, or that there is more to the soundscape than what the movie is pumping in.
Yes.
It's almost like man is trying to trick your ears into hearing more.
Yes.
And that doesn't happen very often, because in most cases and in most movies, they go louder, bigger, 5.1, put it all in there. Let's just envelop the audience and just make them fucking deaf afterwards. And, you know, if you look at any Michael Mann movie, look at the big bank chase, you know, the bank heist scene in Heat. That is as loud a decibel level a movie can get.
Yes.
And the same thing applies here.
That Heat Blu-rays caused more neighborhood complaints than almost every teen party. As soon as you fucking get to that thing, you think you have it under control every time, and it will literally wake up everyone in your family and everyone in the adjoining house without a doubt.
And there's moments that, like, especially in the Blu-ray, which has that 5.1 sound, where the silence is so different from what we were just hearing before. Now, everything from, you know, I believe the moment when Hawkeye and Uncas and everybody jumps out of the waterfall, you know, which in and of itself is such a beautifully surreal moment in an otherwise grounded movie. Because if you look at how man watches them fall in slow-mo, but then has them it shows them falling in three separate shots, and they're not continuous. It almost feels like a German expressionism film. It's a weird, like, with all of the water cascading around them in slow motion, with the sound effects kind of dialing themselves down, it's very surrealist in a way that kind of creates this, you know, beauty in the chaos. Yeah. And then everything goes completely silent. And there's a power to that that I don't think filmmakers use today, that I wish more did. I'm writing notes down for myself as well. But that's a true confidence in your audience, because other than having it be something that is part of the storytelling process, like in Mission Impossible, the first one, when De Palma drops all the sound out, there's a story reason for that. And that, like, that silence is that creates the tension. Here, I think man is doing that specifically to allow your eyes to take over in that moment and enjoy the sweep of the scope.
Yes, and a couple of them
without having to be pumped in, you know.
Yeah, and a couple of them he pairs with a visual, so it's like he's got there's a ballsiness, because a few times he does it and it doesn't immediately correspond with the visual that you're looking at. But there's one of them I remember, there's like where you see a hand into gently embrace a plant. I think it's Uncas's hand, and he moves the plant. That reapproach to the Cameron plantation before, you know, post what they think is a war party with the French coming through. And when he does that, it is deathly silent. Mm-hmm. And it's like before that he even touches the plant, it's deathly silent. Then when you see his hand approach the plant and he touches it, it might just like, there's like this tiny like paper shuffle, like just it's a grating sound, but it's so low in the frequency that you just realize that he's so perfectly just sort of making his way through the woods in deathly silence that, yeah, it's I think it's a focus technique, right? And like you said, the confidence of going, I'm going to shift with the continuity ever so slightly just to get, you know, to make something a little bit more surreal and subjective, because it's kind of that pairing. It's a pairing of like, we're in from an objective view, but everyone knows if you, you know, even stick your head under the shower, like, you know, all of your sound gets messed up. And so I think there's that thing of like, you're kind of feeling what it's like to be enveloped by water in the same moment. So it's, this is where in each it's that funny thing, Joe, where you go in each moment, for each moment, we'll do everything that serves that moment to its fullest potential. And sometimes that's not by adhering to the consistency of a rule book around what you should and shouldn't do. It's just like what he is feeling at that moment. And so
instinctual. It feels very instinctual. Very it almost instinctive. Feels like something that he did not plan at first. I mean, knowing Michael Mann, he probably did, but you know, it feels almost effortless, where they're, you know, in the mix stage, and we've just been pummeled emotionally by that ending, and now we're going into the final sweeping pan shot as we get to what's left of our, you know, of our heroes as they're, you know, bidding Uncas goodbye on that cliffside. And again, that's another moment where there is no sound until we get to them. There's also another sound thing that I noticed when you have all of these crazy, you know, crazy action at the end of the film, and Russell Means gets his comeuppance and gets his revenge, and Magua falls into the frame. I never noticed this before, but there's a difference between when you're in the sound of the sound mixing stage, there's a difference between the natural sound that you've captured on the day, that your sound record is captured on the day, and stuff that would be considered like ADR or just, you know, Foley or whatever.
Yes.
And what I noticed is until we get to Hawkeye and Korra converging and hugging again, you can hear the sound change into the natural sound of them colliding and hugging and crying, which I got a quick side note. It's a very confident and ballsy of a filmmaker to cast two people with exactly the same hair. because in that moment, Madeline Stowe and Daniel Day-Lewis are together. They're holding each other. And in most cases, you would want to have people with slightly different hair color so that you could differentiate between the two. And here, it almost feels like that was the whole point.
The whole point is that matching.
Converge as one. And then you don't know who is who. They are just one being in that moment.
I blame Michael Mann for a lot of things. One of them is having guys who have long hair that like many men aspire to and think that they're so goddamn good looking, like Daniel Day-Lewis and his long hair. And you're like, I'm never going to be able to grow that long hair. It's never going to look that good. I'm going to look like a weirdo. And I can't do that. It's so, so luscious. And even Colin Farrell's Miami Vice hair, which again is ahead of its time. It's
just Kilmer's hair in Heat.
Val Kilmer's hair. Like, you just, all the time, you're like, God, all these guys with this luscious hair. I'm just never going to be able to do it. I'm just going to have to stick with my Neil McCauley short back and sides. And that's all that's going to happen for the rest of my life. God
but
damn
if
it.
You ever watch it again, listen to how the you know, the sound has a different quality in that moment when they converge, but it makes you almost like retroactively appreciate what the sound design was in that previous 11 minutes or so, because it borderlines on surrealism.
Yes.
And just the way that he uses score for those final 12 minutes in like kind of an overture that brings everything together, that is the most sweeping part of the film, and yet it's not the biggest war scene, it's not the ambush scene. Those scenes have no score. There's nothing to them. They're, you know, it's using the sound design of the muskets and the, you know, and the Native Americans screeching and all the violent, you know, sound effects of bones hitting, you know, weapons, the horses neighing, people screaming, that's the score. And that kind of chaos is so much more exciting when you don't lean on having some kind of sweeping Trevor Jones or even like a James Horner type score that highlights all the bombastic action. You know, you get that in the French and Indian War stuff, and even that feels kind of superfluous and it almost feels secondary.
Yes.
It's these big moments that keep it silent, and yet the most emotionally impactful scene gets the biggest cue. Like, again, that's Michael Mann breaking the rules, knowing the rules.
Knowing them and then breaking them.
That's the Michael Mann way. Knowing the language enough that you can break them. And whether it's a modernized film like Thief or Heat to a classical film like Last of the Mohicans, which again, would a lot of people say, oh, it's Michael Mann's period film. I don't believe that. I wouldn't subscribe to that at all. That is just another, that is, if anything, that's Michael Mann's most romantic film that just so happens to be set in the French Indian War.
Yeah, there's, as part of the show, I've spoken to the awesome Chris Tapley, and we were talking.
Oh, I love Chris.
And Chris is, because of how embedded he was in the industry news segment, he talked about Michael Mann tinkering with, Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea.
Mm-hmm, I remember that.
And potentially that being a project and another Western. And so Chris was asking at the end of the show, was like, I think this
the more that we talk about this movie as just a potential flex for Michael Mann's creativity, it's like, wouldn't you love to see Michael Mann go back and do a couple more period movies because of just what he can bring to it? Like, that's that authenticity, that...
Look at Ali. I mean, Ali's a period piece, you know, and I think it gets bogged down a little bit with, you know, the fact that it's considered more a Will Smith vehicle than it is a Michael Mann movie.
Yes.
But when you hear those stories about how, you know, during the big Rumble in the Jungle fight and he can see some dude's belt buckle from like a mile away and go, oh, no, we got to go get that fucking belt buckle out of the shot. You know, it's like, but that's, I want to be taken on a ride by that general.
Yeah.
If anyone's listening to this has the Blu-ray, there's a 45-minute documentary on the making of it that's told in three parts that has footage that looks like it was shot today.
Yes.
I don't think we would ever have that kind of archival footage. It looks like 16mm that they were shooting. But to see the lengths that they went to create this world around what could have just been a fucking love story.
Yes.
It makes you appreciate the craft that goes into it, but at the same time, that craft only gets you so far.
Yes.
It's the sweeping romance that this movie has, wearing its heart on its sleeve, that's the true set piece of what Michael Mann was doing. And I think it is one of the sexiest movies ever made.
Oh my God.
I fully believe that. That makeout scene, nothing much happens. Nothing much happens.
Doesn't it, Joe? Is it not the greatest standing shag that's ever been done in the history of shagging? Because
I think it's more of a snog.
Right. I when I go back and watch it now, when I was younger, I was like, it's the most passionate snog ever. And now when I watch it, I'm like, nah, something's going down. Something's going down.
I don't think so. If they did exchange fluids or not, other than what came out of their mouths, if there was actual, I hate to say, intercourse or lovemaking,
lovemaking.
It's periphery. You know, the kiss and the looks that they give is more powerful, sexy.
I think also just everything about the directness of their exchanges also bleeds into the other directness of the exchange that happened in this movie. But just like, there is something, is there not a more badass line, like, as a dude, when she's like, what are you looking at, sir? And he's like, I'm looking at you, miss. Like,
oh God, I got like, chills just
like,
thinking about
you're
it.
Like, oh, I wish I was that fucking cool in my whole life. I wish I've ever been that cool just to say that. And then that's where the exchange happens and looks, and it's so great. But the dialogue is so deliberate. You know, everything that Day-Lewis gets to deliver, you know, I think you and I are going to have a serious disagreement. Like, just bang, bang, bang. He's just dropping bombs. Like, every great line in the movie, he does actually have it. So, thank you so much for doing this with me. Thanks for coming back.
Dude, anytime, if you need more Mohican talk, I can totally do it. That's great.
This is only a limited series, a little dalliance, I thought. You know, I have had the luxury of experiencing one of the greatest, you know, kind of positive outpourings of support and love around One Heat Minute, and you were there for like the whole journey. So I can't thank you enough. And so when
my pleasure, and listening along the whole time.
I know you were. And so when the opportunity came to talk to Mr. Mann again about one of his great films, it was just like it felt only in keeping with the show that there should be a limited series, at least, that talks about this profoundly incredible final act and the finale.
The best thing that you can do out of this, you know, is we get more people to watch the movie, because I've noticed in recent years not a lot of people talk about this movie.
And it was especially in the main canon. It's his most successful movie. Yeah. Financially ever. And so at the time it was one of those ones where lots more people had seen Mohicans than had seen Heat, even when I began the One Heat Minute journey. But I feel like when you say Michael Mann, it's one of the last films that people now mention.
It becomes almost a postscript, where if you think about it from a financial standpoint, we wouldn't have Heat if there wasn't Last of the Mohicans.
Correct.
Because if that movie didn't do well, I don't think Warner Brothers would have given him the leeway to do a 2-hour, 45-minute crime epic.
Warner Brothers
Warner Brothers banked on him 100% because of the good grace of Mohicans. Like, Mohicans was a smash for them. Like, what, 20 million? Yeah. I think it made 100. It was in the top 20 movies of that year, or like made 60 or something like that. So it made like at least triple its budget back. So that's huge. But look, thank you so much for being a part of this little thing. It's going
to
be so
fun. Well, let me just say, when you come up with a plan to do the insider scoop, I will totally be there.
Well, look,
if you want to do
I can say now my insanely talented friend Maria Lewis, a journalist and writer, and I are doing Josie and the Podcats. I'm producing that with her, which is a 6-episode limited series about Josie and the Pussycats.
One of my favorite movies of the 90s. That came out later.
And if people are listening to this, and it's before we've actually released Josie, we have Rachel Lee Cook, Kay Hanley. We've got a murderer's row lined up for that show. It's an absolutely wonderful thing that we've been able to pull together on that. So that's coming, and I'm just producing that alongside her. The other one for fans who are listening, and I suppose I'll say this and I'll keep it in the episode, is Travis Woods, who's a terrific writer for Brightwall Dark Room and joined me on One Hit Minute a couple of times, I have collaborated. Well, I kind of pushed him into it, if you like, a new deep dive podcast on his favorite film, which I'm producing, called Increment Vice, which is the Inherent Vice, not minute by minute podcast. It's more like exchange by exchange, scene by scene, interaction by interaction, 45 episode series, which is launching very soon as well. So those ones are there. And of course, you're now listening to the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans. And so a couple of good ones coming up.
You're doing God's work, Blake. Thank you very much.
Guys, Joe Lynch, the incredible talent behind Mayhem, which I'm so glad is just getting more and more love around Ready or Not coming out. People
major signal boost because it was that back movie that people would walk around and go, oh yeah, if you saw Ready or Not, you should check out Mayhem. I'm like, thank you very much.
There you go. Like, it all helps. Then the Samara Weaving, completest catalog, people are going back to Mayhem, and also the Steven Yuen, which people are going back and doing. So that's great. Obviously, Point Blank on Netflix, one of the most popular action movies ever released on the entire platform. And this man was the director. Mate, thank you so much for being a part of it. I can't wait to chat to you more on whatever the next mad thing I undertake.
Let's do it.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 2 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.